You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
I couldn't hear because there was so much shooting outside. There was so much noise. I couldn't hear what London were asking. I said, hold on, Mum, I've got to close the window. And I heard afterwards that the entire studio said, no, leave the window open, leave the window open, because they wanted to hear the shooting.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. In this episode, we talk again to Mark Brain, who worked as a Reuters and BBC journalist during the Cold War. This time, we are in Romania in December 1989, where riots, street violence and murder in several cities over the course of roughly a week led to the Romanian leader Nicolae Ceaușescu to flee the capital on the 22nd of December with his wife. We hear the challenges of being a journalist in what was effectively a war zone without the risk assessments and protective gear of the present day. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave written reviews in Apple Podcasts or share us on social media. By telling your friends, you can really help the podcast grow. If you can spare it, I'm asking listeners to contribute $3 per month to help keep us on the air. Larger amounts are welcome too. Plus, you get a sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster as a monthly financial supporter, and you bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. Back to today's episode. This is part three of three episodes with Mark, and it's been an honour for Mark to share his stories with us in such an honest and revealing fashion. We welcome Mark Brain back to our Cold War conversation. Tell me about Romania in 1989.
I thought you were going to say, tell me about Romania in 90 seconds. Without deviation, repetition, or pausing. Right, Romania in 90 seconds in 1989. Having missed all of the big stories, doing my bit covering the diplomatic dimension, and that had to be done from London, but I was very aware that this was my patch. This was a patch I'd been covering for years, and this was the biggest story on the planet, and I wasn't there. So Thursday the 21st, you know, we'd been getting reports from Timișoara. There was shooting. Clearly, things were not good, or were interesting in Romania. The last domino to fall after the Czech Republic had gone and Todor Zhivkov had gone in Bulgaria. So apart from Albania, Ceaușescu was the last old guard holdout. And he, despite what was happening in Timișoara and the shootings there, had thought he was still in control. He had this hubris. He and Yelena Ceaușescu genuinely believed that the people loved them, that this was a passing problem. He went on a state visit to Iran, totally convinced that he would be fine. There wouldn't be a coup against him in his absence, which is true. There wasn't. But while he was away, the revolution, the resistance began to brew pretty intensely. And he came back. So it was based in Timișoara, and it was sort of under control. The army was still on top of it. The Securitate was still loyal to Ceaușescu. And he came back from Iran triumphant and full of his misplaced pride and confidence, and called this big rally on Revolution Square on Thursday, December the 21st, I think it was. And I'm following this on the morning of that Thursday, and preparing and thinking, if this one blows, this is a story I need to cover. I got to be there, even though Christmas was coming up. So I got a call from Mick Atkin, an old Leeds University colleague of mine, fellow student. We both studied Russian together at Leeds in the 68 to 73. And Mick was by then working with BBC Monitoring. And he gave me a call as diplomatic correspondent and said, Mark, I think you need to know, we've just been listening to the broadcast from Revolution Square, and we're pretty certain that we're hearing chanting, and they've just cut the broadcast and they've gone to music. Really weird what's happening. I think you need to know. And I thought, hello, this is it. So I put a report straight away on the BBC and said, what Mick had reported, and we had a clip of the sound, and actually you could hear in the background Jos Komunismul, down with communism, down with Ceausescu. Of course, history now, we know what happened, and the crowd turned against him, and he went inside and flew off on the helicopter and all of that on that day. Well, I now was in hyperactive mode. So on that Thursday afternoon, I said to my BBC bosses, guys, I got to be there. We didn't have anybody in Bucharest, and I knew Romania. I'd been the correspondent covering Romania in the early 80s, so I had a pretty good claim to go. John Simpson for BBC Television was making similar arguments to the television lot, but in those days, radio and television didn't even talk to each other, let alone cooperate. So I said to my bosses, to Peter Brooks, who was the entire foreign desk, one man, Bush House. Ian Richardson was with him as well. So it was a tiny operation. And I hope Ian Richardson listens to this. You ought to talk to him, because he was with us in Beijing in that summer. It was a very important part of our operation there. I got permission from the Beeb to go. So I summoned up, I got a suitcase, and put just a huge pile of tapes, blank tapes, equipment, a mutter box, which was an Ian Richardson invention, which you used with crocodile clips to connect onto a telephone to enhance the volume of the report down the telephone line, because you didn't have broadband or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So mutter box, I had a mutter box mixer, which was state of the art, really amazing. And $10,000 in cash, which I managed to get from, I don't know where I got it from. Somebody managed to conjure up $10,000 in cash. So off I went and stayed that Thursday night at a hotel on the outskirts of Heathrow, ready to take the very first flight out the following day to Vienna. Via Vienna to Belgrade. I was thinking probably the best way in, because Romania is very big, to get in through Hungary from Vienna is going to be difficult because they closed the borders and so on. Because we were hearing, there was shooting and the army was cracking down. It was really, really getting very, very bloody in Bucharest. The army had not yet switched sides. So I flew to Vienna and then tried to hire a plane, a small plane in Vienna, to charter a plane to get into Romania, but I couldn't find one. I was on my own, just, with no preparation for a hostile environment. It was a war zone, basically. I just had a great big suitcase full of kit and kit and dollars. So I flew on to Belgrade, and at Belgrade Airport, I came out of the terminal and the taxi rank, and I said, who can take me? Anybody ready to take me to Bucharest over the Iron Gates, over the Danube? Can't remember his name, but one of these guys said, yeah, I'll take you. So put the suitcase with all my kit in the back of the car, and he drove home just to say to his wife, I'm off to Romania. And she said, you must be nuts. There were reports at the time that they'd poisoned the water supply in Bucharest. It was pretty scary.
Yeah.
But I wasn't terribly scared, funnily enough. So we drove off from Belgrade, and he had the meter ticking. So it was a metered taxi ride, and we drove over to the Iron Gates, to where the crossing into Romania was over the dam on the Danube, and the Romanian guards wouldn't let me in. So I sat around thinking, what do I do now? What shall I do? And put in a report to the World Service down the telephone line saying what I was observing. And then with the driver, I thought, sod this, we'll go. We just went across and we blagged our way through. And this was about 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning. And then we just drove through the night, through completely deserted, it was nighttime, into Bucharest. Arrived in Bucharest just as dawn, as the sun was coming, this blood red dawn on Saturday, December the 23rd, I think it was. So I'd Friday I got to Belgrade, then drove in overnight Friday night into Bucharest. And we tried to get across the main square outside the Intercontinental Hotel where all the foreigners were would always be put up. But there was shooting and there were roadblocks. The army had switched sides in the meantime. So now it was a kind of civil war and the army were fighting the Securitate. So I skirted round. I got the driver to skirt round Revolution Square, not Revolution Square, round in front of the Intercontinental, just to try to find a hotel, because this was about London time. This was about 8 o'clock in the morning. So the Today program was still on air. And I thought, I've got to get onto the Today program.
Yeah.
That was the top priority. So we drove round to the edge of town. And there was a lot of military around, and you could hear a lot of shooting. And I managed to find a hotel called the Hotel Modern, about 10 minutes walk from, no, maybe 15 minutes walk from the Intercontinental. And I pulled up outside and I said to the driver, wait a minute, went in and I said to Veronica Muntiano, who was the hotel manager on the desk, I said, didn't know her name at that point, needless to say. I said, I'm from the BBC. I've just arrived. I've got to get a telephone line to London. Can you get me a telephone line to London? She said, yes, we'll try. So I went up to a room and I got a hand-knitted telephone line to London. Sent the driver off and with $1,870 in his pocket, which is the most expensive taxi fare I've ever paid. And this is 1989. That's a lot
of money. Did you get a receipt?
I got a receipt.
Good.
I can send you a copy. I've got scanned receipt. I did. You had to have receipt. Oh,
fantastic.
Anyway, so I got a line into London, which I then kept open for the next week. I didn't let go of that line because it was really hard to get telephone lines out of Bucharest. I kept that single line open for 1 week as the story unfolded. So I reported live into the Today program. And I remember, well, I couldn't hear because there was so much shooting outside. There was so much noise. I couldn't hear what London were asking. I said, hold on, mum, I've got to close the window. And I heard afterwards that the entire studio said, no, leave the window open, because they wanted to hear the shooting.
They wanted the sound effects.
They wanted sound effects. They were the real thing, mate.
Yeah, I know. They wanted So did you beat John Simpson to punch or not?
I have never in my life met John Simpson. I didn't meet him there. We were there for 2 weeks overlapping. He was in the Intercontinental Hotel doing the TV operation.
Yeah.
Very, very bravely. So we were actually going down to Revolution Square and reporting the same story, but we never teamed up at all. I mean, it was bonkers. I mean, it was how the BBC worked in those days, and it's a jolly good thing that it doesn't work like that anymore. So I was reporting for radio from the Modern, which was not very modern. Oh, and Veronica, the acoustics were terrible in the room. So I said to Veronica, you know, I need some sound padding. So she was just wonderful. We got some mattresses from all the rooms, put them up against the wall and nailed them to the wall with 6-inch nails. And I've got a photograph of that. You've actually got the sound proofing in this room with these mattresses nailed to the wall.
Wow.
But John was reporting from the Intercontinental. Everybody else was in the Intercontinental and I was completely on my own. With this line, I didn't dare leave the Modern because I had this line into London. So I would go out for 2 hours, go and walk around the square and find out what was going on, talk to people, get sound effects, you know, get a sense of what was going on, go down to the Central Party headquarters, the old former Central Committee building. The army were still shooting at snipers. It was, you know, pretty bloody. The library had gone up in flames. I had a bullet go right past my ear as well. You can hear that on one of my reports. Very irresponsible, to be honest. You know, flak jackets or anything, forget it. We had no gear whatsoever. And I'd go back then to the hotel, beetle back to the hotel at speed, and with 10 minutes flat to the top of the hour, we'd put together a 90-second report written in 10 minutes. I've never written so fluently in my life. And then go live into the top of the hour, sort of every 2 hours into Radio Newsreel or the 6 o'clock news or wherever.
And you weren't afraid of being shot?
Ian.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's libsynads.com.
If anybody listening to this is curious about how somebody can have such a crazy experience and not be afraid, a bit of personal revelation. I've actually just had a formal diagnosis of Asperger's, which explains my difficulty with marriages through the years, which I finally got the hang of. And funnily enough, makes me quite a good psychotherapist now. But looking back, I can see that was why I was fearless. I mean, it bounced off the sides. Crazy. The most frightening moment I ever had was in Kosovo in the beginning of 1990, because I'd just finished covering the end of the last conference in Belgrade of the Yugoslav Communist Party, the League of Communists of Yugoslavia, interviewed Milosevic at 2:30 in the morning, and I really felt in the presence of evil. I didn't put that on my list. Literally, I felt in the presence of evil. And I went down.
Why did you feel that with Milosevic?
Icy cold. It was like shaking hands with the ice queen. The most extraordinary experience. And the party broke up in the morning when the Croats and the Slovenes walked out. And that was the end of Yugoslavia, the end of the LCY, and then the end of Yugoslavia. And I went on down to Kosovo because there was violence in Kosovo. So the Albanians, the ethnic Albanians, were beginning to kick back against the Serbs. And there hadn't yet been a death, but I went down to Kosovo and did some reporting from the Grand Hotel in Pristina. And we went out to one of the towns, and the Serbian police were tear gassing demonstrators. And in the taxi, we got caught between the police lines and the demonstrators. It was relatively benign in a sense. It was only tear gas. And the police used us driving between the two in the taxi as cover to fire tear gas over our heads at the demonstrators. And that was the most frightened I've ever been, probably ever, actually. Yeah. I literally cowered in the well of the back of the car. I bounced back pretty damn quick. But in Romania, I wasn't frightened. No, I wasn't frightened. I took stupid risks, but didn't get quite as close to the action as John did. John Simpson's reports, so when I look at them on YouTube, he was closer to the action than I was. And he was, you know, credit where credit is due, bloody good reporting. And I think his reporting from Romania was better than mine.
I'll have to find those clips.
There are some on my some of mine on my website on psychotherapists, if you want to feed them in. Yeah,
thank you. What was the BBC's guidance for you there? Was it like, don't do anything stupid, or what, you know, what was the guidance, and what was the, you know, if you had got killed, were they paying for life insurance, or what was the deal being a journalist in a situation like that?
There wasn't one. Go and report. You know, it was,
and that's it.
The naivety of it is one of the reasons that through the 90s I became very involved with hostile environment training and getting people kitted out and coordinated in a much better way to cover bad stories like that in ways that wouldn't get them killed. The BBC changed its culture completely with the death of John Schofield in Croatia during Operation Storm in May, June, summer of 1995. And Chris Kramer, who was then head of news gathering at the BBC, when John got killed by a Croatian sniper? I can't remember which sniper it was. Maybe it was a Serbian sniper. He was in a place, actually he shouldn't have been, but he was doing a job of work that he thought was a good one. He had all the gear, had helmets and flak jackets and so on, but there wasn't a proper coordination of BBC news gathering. And so the BBC was shocked into action in 1995 and completely changed its culture to train everybody up for hostile environments, including ultimately the psychological impact of reporting from hostile environments, which is an area that I then went on to specialize in. But when I did it, Peter Brooks and Ian Richards said, off you go, study boy. You know, they were wonderfully supportive. And I went in naked, basically, and survived it.
Being in a situation like that, you must have seen some sights there that you'd never seen before as well.
Well, I remember going to the mortuary in Bucharest with about, I lost count of the bodies, at least 60 bodies, and young people just piled up because they had so many come in from the from the protests and the shootings on the main drag down the middle of, what's it called? Magurianu, I think. The main drag through the middle of Bucharest. And they piled the bodies up in the mortuary in the cool house. And they hadn't had any time to treat them with any dignity. I mean, they were laid out. But these young people, it was quite a sight. It was quite a sight.
That must be something that really stays with you, being through something like that and seeing things like that.
Yes, and no. The maybe because I'm Asperger's, I was able to experience it and report it very objectively. In fact, I think what did happen to me, what stayed with me, was that I was very inspired, very worked up emotionally about the meaning of the story I was covering. And I'd had that on Tiananmen Square as well. And that my journalistic judgment took a really nasty jolt. I did a lot of good reporting, but there were one or two reports where I sort of lost the plot, to be honest. Lack of sleep, particularly from Beijing. I thought that the army were going to be siding with the students and the demonstrators, the 38th Army that was coming into Beijing. In the aftermath, we discovered that, yes, the commander of the 38th Army was on the side of Zhao Ziyang, not the side of Li Peng, the very hardline prime minister at the time. But I got swept up in the enthusiasm of the moment. And I certainly know that that happened on Tiananmen Square and that happened in Bucharest. And that was part, if you like, of what the emotional intensity of what I covered was with me when I left Bucharest and on by train, because the airport hadn't yet opened up. And the only way to get out of Romania at the beginning of 1990, January the 6th, no, overnight train, January the 5th to the 6th, so I went to Budapest. And it had been such an intense emotional experience, not much so much seeing the bodies, but the joy, the sheer unadulterated relief of that the nightmare was over. The Romanian people had sort of woken up from this terrible nightmare. And people who say it wasn't a revolution, it was a revolution, there's no question. Yes, was it hijacked by Iliescu and the old guard? Yes, it was. Of course it was. That's what happens to these things. But was it a genuine revolution? 100%. I have absolutely no doubt at all that it was a very powerful movement coming up from below. So it was very affecting. And I'm not a cynic. You know, a lot of journalists see things always cynically, and I'm afraid I used to get very enthusiastic about the stories I covered. I used to identify enormously with the people within those stories. So I was emotionally very raw, very naked when I left Bucharest. And I saw a young Hungarian girl, 17 years younger than me, on the other end of the train corridor. And sort of the rest is history in the sense that all sorts of things flowed from that moment, which included turning into psychotherapy, trying to rescue my marriage, eventually my wife realizing that the old story wasn't over. And so she divorced me in 2000. I then remarried somebody else. The Hungarian girl and I kept trying to meet each other. And I was available, she wasn't. When she was available, I wasn't. And one thing led to another. I then became quite a good trauma therapist, left the BBC, set up the DART, Center for Journalism and Trauma, which is all still doing really good work in Europe, that is, and did the European operation for the DART Center, funded by the DART Container Corporation charity in the States. And we really made a difference in journalism. And I left them in 2008, cycled back out to Budapest, as one does, to see this girl, to try and work things out, came back, tried to rescue my marriage, finally failed, and remarried my first wife in 2013, and we're now living happily ever after. So there's a Cold War story that has a happy ending.
That's an incredible Cold War story. So appreciate you sharing that with me and the listeners. But there's a few more bits I just want to dig into.
Yeah.
There's Vasil Bilyak.
Oh, good grief. Yes, we haven't done Vasil Bilyak.
Bilyak.
There's a little hook on the L because he's Slovak. So Bilyak. It's a soft L, like a Russian ya.
Right. Okay.
Okay, Vasil Bilyak. So, right. Yeah. Nasty old hardliner. So the story about Vasil Bilyak is in 1982, I think it was, around the time of Abel Archer, the famous NATO exercises in West Germany, which the Russians misinterpreted as preparation for a nuclear attack, where the Russians, with the Americans, were bringing Pershing and cruise missiles to Europe, and the Russians were threatening and then deploying, threatening to deploy and deploying SS-20s much closer to Western Europe to shorten the time. So it was really the absolute height of the Cold War.
Yeah. Hair that triggered. was 83 Able Archer.
So yeah. It must have been, right, no. 83. So that was when it must have been working with the STB, but a Brit who'd stayed in Czechoslovakia after 48, 49, and he was a lovely man who was a sort of journalist on the fringes of, and he certainly had good connections into the security apparatus. And he was my fixer in Prague, and he would set up my interviews for me, and he was very good. I was very fond of him. I can't remember his name, Carl maybe. Maybe a listener will remember the name, because a lot of Western journalists worked with him. And I'd asked for a high-level interview at the time of all this tension, you know, because they were threatening the Russians, and the Soviets were talking about deploying SS-20s in Czechoslovakia, much closer to the German border and the West and NATO's borders. So I got an interview through this chap with Vasil Bilyak, who was the hardliner on the Czechoslovak Politburo, who had been leading figure in inviting the Russians in 1968. So he was that small group who have now understood as traitors, who invited the Russians. He was put on trial later, I think, for treachery after the fall of communism. But anyway, I got an interview with him in one of the Central Committee buildings in Prague. And the deal was that I had to give him written questions, and he would write his answers, and I would read the questions, and he would read his answers, and otherwise he wouldn't do it. It was an absolute, there was no follow up. It was a scripted interview. I mean, why I agreed to it, I don't know. I was very naive as a journalist at that stage in many ways, but I agreed to that, and so got this interview. And we recorded it, duly recorded it, and I didn't ask any recorded follow up questions, but switched the recorder off, and he started chatting. How it happened, I don't know, Ian, but the most extraordinary thing, and I can't remember what else he said, but he sort of saw me as a son or something, and he started sort of talking totally off the record, but he didn't say it was off the record, and why I didn't report this, I don't know. I mean, really, it was the best story I never reported, and I've never, ever told this story publicly. I don't think I have, anyway. Certainly never did a From Erin correspondent on it. I never put it on the news. It wasn't a news story as such. It was a reflection of the curiosity and craziness of Eastern Europe at that time, real people managing an unreal system. Anyway, he was talking about his early years as communist leader, a senior communist figure, rather, in Slovakia, because he's from Slovakia with the name Bilyak. And he was telling me about his task in the early 50s was to clean up prostitution in Košice, I think it was, in the depths of Slovakia, the far in eastern Slovakia up against the Ukrainian border. Well, then Soviet border. And he was telling me this story that he volunteered that the curious thing about people, about women and prostitutes, is they didn't really want to give up their trade. And so he told me this story that they were closing down the brothels and pulling prostitutes in and re-educating them. I don't know how many of them were putting on trial. It seemed to be relatively benign. But he said, he described that he'd had this encounter with this madam, this brothel owner, or brothel manager, I imagine, in sort of 51, 52, at the height of Stalinism, before Stalin died.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
And he said how this madam had said to him, "Mr. Bilyak, you We are the oldest profession. You can do what you like, but no one will ever close down this trade. You have to understand that. And he described how she walked behind him and rested her voluminous breasts on his head as she said this. My goodness me.
It's bizarre.
What was he doing telling me that story? I mean, I could have put that on air. I mean,
yeah.
What at the height of Abel Archer, the story was, you know, the Czechs are threatening this. And it was quite a big story. It led the world service for several hours. But if I'd added, oh, and by the way, Vesel Bilak described how this prostitute, this madam, plonked her vast breasts on his head and said, you'll never wipe us out. There was nowhere to put it.
Yeah. I mean, was it almost as though after he'd done the scripted interview, the mask fell and he just chatted with you?
He was just human. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he was sort of, I was quite an engaging young man. I was sort of quite good at interviewing because I wasn't sort of heavy and political and attacking old John Humphreys or anything like that. I was quite kind and curious and open. And I think he trusted me in that moment. But I don't know whether he planned, whether he thought I was going to report it, or I think he probably said, you know, don't report this one, but, you know, let's talk about human nature. So yeah. I came away with an awareness, you know, which I knew from East Germany, that these are ordinary people. Crap system, but perfectly ordinary people.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's interesting seeing behind that, because the only image you see of these people most of the time is the official image. And it's often, you know, really difficult to just see them as people who have kids who don't behave and, you know, the same stuff that everybody else has to deal with to some degree.
Yeah. But I think, you know, looking back, when you think of the messiness around the demise of East Germany and the confusions over the press conference when Schabowski says, what's this here? Something about sort of, you know, anybody can travel. Yeah, it's probably starting now. And then Egon Krenz and people who sort of try and take it over. And you realize that they're just ordinary people struggling, you know, with incredibly complex situations.
And so much of history is not conspiracy. It's just cock up.
Oh, totally. Totally. The stories that came out with the end of the Soviet Union, when we realized that this vast, great Soviet military machine threatening the West, they were terrified. They genuinely thought the West was going to attack them, and they were monitoring lights going on and off at NATO headquarters, thinking this is signaling the beginnings of an attack. You can make it all ideological, but actually it's intensely human.
Yeah.
And it's also groupthink, that people in a closed environment begin to hear their own feedback and persuade themselves that of the truth of whatever crazy idea they've come up with.
But that was the thing with Abel Archer, is that Andropov had put this Operation Rhiann in place, which was to look out for the KGB to look out for signs of military preparations, such as lights on in offices late at night and stuff like that. And the KGB, knowing that's what Andropov wanted to hear, were trying to find stuff that matched up to that, rather than actually look out for legitimate military preparations.
Well, the fascinating thing that I probably need to write a book about, Ian, if I ever get round to writing a book, or at least include or write about, I don't know if I ever will at this stage in life, but the psychology of all of this fascinates me. And I now work with individuals with trauma, the aftermath of trauma, whether it's war trauma or rape or car crashes or just childhood and boarding school and parental divorce and, you know, sexual abuse and the stuff that just being bullied on the playground and mummy not getting it. This is the stuff I work with all the time. And the fascinating thing about human nature is that we assume that our internal reality is a kind of shared reality. So if I, working in the KGB and being Russian, experience the world through Russian eyes, and we do mokrie rabote, whatever the word is, you know, wet jobs that the KGB do, where we assassinate people we don't like, and we assume that every diplomat is an undercover spy, and certainly all the journalists are, because all ours are. So the Russians absolutely projected their understanding of themselves out onto the West. So they assumed that the West must be like us, just like the West assumed that the Russians must be thinking like us, building all of these things. They're bound to want to use them or whatever. So the misunderstandings that happen when you assume that your internal reality is also the opposite number's internal reality. I work with couples a lot, and introducing them to the idea that life is not the same on the two islands you live on. You have a bridge between you, but life on Venus is not the same as life on Mars. You know, don't assume that your partner is experiencing things just the way you are. And the differences, difficulties you have in individual relationships are all just acted out on an international level. There's no difference.
Mm.
And it's just people screwing up, trying to get things right, getting them right sometimes, a lot of the time screwing up. And you just hope that you don't have an awful lot of people dying in the process.
That's a really interesting insight.
Oh, I got to tell you one thing about the 4+2 negotiations.
Oh, go on then.
All right. One final anecdote. You know, you can split this into multiple broadcasts.
I am. Don't worry. I am. I don't think anybody's going to sit. Well, they probably will sit through 3 hours, but I'm not so sure.
Well, we haven't quite made it to 3 hours.
So not quite.
Anyway, the Germans called them, of course, the 2+4 negotiations, you know, the two Germanys plus the four Allied powers. Well, we called them, being the Allied powers, me being diplomatic correspondent, we called them the 4+2. So the negotiation went around Germany. There was one in East Berlin. There was one in Bonn. I went to most of them. And the one in Berlin, in East Berlin, which was, of course, still East Berlin, although the wall was open, Shevardnadze was there with a couple of senior generals, I think, were with him. And we had the negotiating teams. It's a bit like what's happening in Brussels at the moment about, you know, Brexit and how well that works out. And the negotiating tactics of the Russians at that point were to, they were negotiating with a very, very weak hand. Their whole system had basically fallen apart. They were falling apart. The Soviet Union was beginning to fall apart. You know, they really didn't have very much clout at that point, but they were rattling their sabers as loud as they could to try and force the West into, ideally, German neutrality. They wanted to get the whole of Germany, if it was going to be reunited, they wanted it neutral, and they wanted an overarching, you know, CSCE European peace concord that included Russia with a major voice, you know, sort of the end of NATO, but just a pan-European security system. And of course, the West was having none of this and didn't trust the Russians as far as they could throw them. And in Berlin, Shevardnadze, it seemed to be going well. The negotiations seemed to be going well. And then suddenly, Shevardnadze throws down the gauntlet and says, we insist on, you know, played his trump card. We insist on neutrality. I can't remember the other details. And no membership of NATO for Germany. No. And Heather Pick from The Guardian, bless her, and one or two others took it at face value and thought, oh my God, it's all falling apart. And the Russians are going to pull away and in anger and they won't agree to anything. And I thought, hello, I know the Russians. They're trying to sound much stronger than they really are. And this is Shevardnadze. I got the intuition was dead right at that point. Shevardnadze was acting tough so that he could say to the generals, see, I tried. You know, you wanted the neutral Germany. I did my best. I promise I did my best. You see, it didn't work. And we had to agree to reunification on the West's terms. Basically, you know, the whole of Germany joins NATO, which is exactly what happened. But the negotiating tactic was to make a huge amount of noise, hoping to, you know, not so much to persuade the Western negotiators to make concessions, but to convince those behind you, the hardliners in Moscow, that you really are busting a gut on their behalf. You did everything you could, so you can go back to Moscow and say, okay, we've 400,000 men are going to have to come back. We haven't got anywhere to put them. Never mind. We've lost Poland. We've lost Bulgaria. We've lost Czechoslovakia. We've now lost the German Democratic Republic. But actually, it's all okay because we got a good deal. And of course, people held it against Shevardnadze and Gorbachev, as we know from August 1991. But in that summer of 1990, covering the 4+2 was an inspiring experience. And I think Shevardnadze and Gorbachev are two of the greatest men of the 20th century. Shevardnadze, they brought about the end of a very, very nasty system in lots of ways, almost without bloodshed. Quite extraordinary. Quite extraordinary. Just imagine if Trump had been in the White House.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I'm reading a book at the moment called The Human Factor.
Yeah.
Which is Reagan, Thatcher, Gorbachev, and...
Gorbachev.
Thank Sorry. You, Mark. No, that's fine.
That's Ceausescu, Gorbachev, Khrushchev.
Khrushchev. Yep. There you go.
It's an E with two dots over it.
Okay. And this book is sort of talking about the fact that it was really just almost the right people at the right time.
Totally. I did a radio documentary on that called Mind Games. It was nominated for a Sony Award in 2000. When did I do that? 2000. 2001 with Simon Elms of BBC Radio 4. And we interviewed Baker, James Baker.
Yeah.
We interviewed Douglas Hurd, who was Foreign Secretary at the time. And I wanted to get Genscher. I wanted to get the four foreign ministers, Genscher and Shevardnadze. Genscher said no, unfortunately, as did Shevardnadze. So our representative from Central Europe. So we had Hurd, Baker, and Miklos Németh, the Hungarian Prime Minister who opened the border to Austria, who gave the orders for that to be snipped through. Yeah. And Németh was really impressive. So we had those three big interviews, big set-piece interviews, looking at the psychology, looking at the moments of movement between the relationships between between the men in the room. It was nominated for a Sony Award. We didn't make it, unfortunately. But we also then interviewed Gabrielle Rifkind, who's a psychoanalyst from North London, who works on conflict resolution in the Middle East, Palestinian Israeli, and she's extraordinary. And we had her commenting on the psychological dynamic of those years. It could have gone much deeper. I wasn't ultimately terribly pleased with the documentary, but we had a go at doing exactly what that book you described did, because that's how it happened. It was individuals making it happen.
Yeah. Well, this is this book's about to be published, I think, and they've sent me a review copy, and I'm going to interview the author in a week or so.
On my psychotherapist.com website, I've got the program, the full Mind Games program, which you can listen to.
Right. Okay. This sounds like there's a lot more on your site than I thought there was.
Look under old BBC radio programs or something. There's a whole load of recordings, loads and loads of recordings. I just put my archive on. Okay. But it's been a great pleasure. Lovely to talk to you. And thank you so much for your very kind and open interviewing. It's been a total delight to talk to you.
And we have further photos, videos, and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And if you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where listeners just like you continue the Cold War Conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.